the first case, number 114076, United States of America versus Antonio Flores Martinez.
May it please the court. Good morning. Tim Crooks for the appellant, Antonio Flores Martinez. After a jury trial, Mr. Flores Martinez was convicted of illegal reentry into the United States after deportation. Today, I'd first like to talk to the court about Mr. Flores Martinez's procedural competency claim, that is, his claim respecting the adequacy of the procedures the district court used to determine that he was competent to stand trial. Particularly, Mr. Flores Martinez asserts that before finding him competent to stand trial, the district court should have ordered what defense counsel called an in-house competency examination, psychological examination, meaning that Mr. Flores Martinez would be committed to the custody of the Attorney General to be evaluated for a period of 30 to 45 days at the Federal Medical Center.
The thing that strikes me, though, about this is that Mr. Flores Martinez wasn't saying he was a citizen of Mars or something really crazy. What he was saying actually makes a lot of sense. It's legally wrong, but it makes a lot of sense. Hey, my dad served this country honorably and should have been a citizen, and therefore I should be a citizen. There's nothing illogical or crazy or wild about that. It's just wrong legally. But it makes sense, and he was very consistent in that, and that seemed to be the source of all of the problems that he had in dealing with the court, was his passion for his belief, legally wrong but logically sound, in my view, that he was making. So why would that make you think he's incompetent?
Well, we don't know whether his belief was, in fact, logically sound or whether it was the product of delusional thinking. And in fact, the only medical professional that took a look at Mr. Flores Martinez said that he could not tell whether it was, in fact, as you say, logical but mistaken thinking versus the product of delusional thinking.
But I mean, his dad did serve in World War II, right? I mean,
yes.
All of this was true. He wasn't like thinking little green men had spoken to him or something. He was thinking that his dad's service to this country should count for something. And again, not my policy choice to make. Congress made a different one. But it's not a crazy thing to think. I don't see what's delusional about that.
Well, in certain respects, it was delusional because he told Dr. Moron, for example, that the government had given him permission to be in the United States. And I think clearly the government would dispute that that ever occurred. So to that extent, that would
be a delusion. But that's his construction of the dismissal of his prior case, which again, lay people don't always understand we don't always understand all the intricacies, we as lawyers. And so that's a lay person's construction of the fact that his prior criminal case was dismissed. Again, while wrong, I don't find that delusional.
Well, I think to step back just a little bit, competency has two prongs. One is to understand the nature of the proceedings and the nature of the charges against you. A second prong is to be able to assist in your own defense. And when you have an obsession on these things, however founded in fact they may be, it gets to the point where it interferes with your ability to assist your counsel in his own defense. And that's exactly what defense counsel was saying here. And it's also what Dr. Moron said, is that if he is obsessively fixated on these to the point that it appears to be, he cannot assist in his own defense. But the problem is that Dr. Moron could not make a final conclusion about either prong of competency.
But why was this the district court's responsibility to do this sua sponte? You concede that the counsel never asked for such a hearing, correct?
No, I don't. Mr. Flores Martinez's counsel asked that Mr. Flores Martinez be committed to the custody of the Attorney General for a psychological evaluation, which is the prelude to a competency hearing.
But he never asked for a competency hearing.
We take the position that he did ask for it by asking for the psychological evaluation because...
Is there any authority for that proposition, that asking for the one counts as asking for the other?
just simply the practicality of the matter that you always have a competency hearing after a person has been committed to the custody of the AG for one of these in-house examinations.
So by what standard of review do we view the district court's failure to conduct this hearing?
The standard of review is abuse of discretion. For both the failure to conduct the hearing and the preliminary failure to commit him to the custody of the Attorney General for a psychological evaluation.
What's your best authority that this is abuse of discretion?
Excuse me?
What is your best authority that this was an abuse of discretion on these facts?
I believe the Messer v. case and the Rustin case. I did want to discuss very briefly, before I get into the further merits of the competency claim, the government's recently made argument that that claim is moot. And of course, I'll be glad to entertain any questions, but we filed a very extensive supplemental brief explaining our position why it's not moot.
It seems to me the question of whether the underlying conviction is invalid because it was entered when Mr. Flores Martinez was not competent, in your view, is not moot. Everybody, I think, agrees on that. So that seems to be the heart of the thing. Now, you're—
I don't think the government agrees.
No, I don't think the government disagrees that attacking your conviction is not moot because you've been deported. I think the question is, what relief could we award here? If we agreed with you, the relief may be vacator of the conviction, but it's not dismissal of the whole case. And so then you go back, and then the question is, can you have the competency hearing? And I think that's the government's concern. We may or may not get to that point, depending on how we assess your competency analysis.
Right. Well, I'll be happy to address that now, or I'll be glad to go on with the merits of the competency claim. But let me just say very briefly about that. I think the government is confusing the relief with a means of harmless error analysis that is used in these cases. The nunk-pro-tunk hearing, the retrospective competency hearing, is just a means that courts sometimes use to determine whether a procedural competency error is harmless. In other words, the error may be harmless if, A, you can go back and determine that the person was competent at the time of the original trial, and B, being able to do that, you in fact determine that the defendant is competent. And that is something that courts have sometimes used to determine that an error like this is harmless, because if he was really competent, then there was no problem.
Right, we can't determine that the error was harmless here, but that doesn't affect whether or not we should vacate if we agree with you, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And oftentimes the courts have said that these types of hearings are disfavored anyway. In the three leading Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court declined to order a retrospective competency hearing, those being Drove,
okay, Bay, so let me ask you this. Let's say we agree with you that the judge should have ordered the hearing and didn't, okay? I don't know that that's tantamount to saying Mr. Flores Martinez was, in fact, not competent, okay?
I agree with you.
If we find that there should have been a hearing, what relief do you propose that we grant? Besides vacating the conviction, I'm not prepared to say and dismiss the indictment, et cetera, and go hence without day. What do we do? What is your proposed remedy?
I think the proposed remedy is what happens any time that the defendant is not available, either by means of being out of the country or by continuing to be incompetent. The conviction is vacated, the case remains on the docket, and when and if he is available and is again competent, he may be retried for it. But I agree with you, it's not a dismissal of the indictment. The remedy is to vacate the conviction with the option for the government to retry should he be available and competent at a later date.
But then that's an interesting point. I mean, the reason why the underlying conviction isn't moot, the challenge to it isn't mooted by his completing his sentence and leaving, is because there's collateral consequences to a conviction. And in his case, the biggest collateral consequence is it affects his ability to come here lawfully. Well, if we vacate the conviction, what's the effect on that? Are we then spotting him that he gets to come back potentially lawfully, although I recognize that may be a little bit of a lottery sort of when the prospect of actually coming back lawfully, but let's indulge that. I mean, is that really appropriate that he sort of gets that benefit?
Well, I don't look at it as a benefit. I look at it as an entitlement, because I think everyone is entitled to be convicted only in accordance with constitutional procedures and or statutory procedures. And if he was unlawfully convicted, then he should not have the attendant disabilities of that conviction.
It's sort of circular because we don't know that. In other words, if we agree with you that there's some question about his competency, so we vacate the conviction. Were he, you know, here, we'd send it back, have a competency hearing, whatever we'd do. All right, he's not here. So we vacate the conviction. So now he's in the position where he doesn't have the penalty of this conviction to prevent his lawful entry, and let's say he's able to get a visa or whatever to come in, that he couldn't have otherwise gotten and shouldn't have gotten, perhaps. It seems kind of circular. Or are you saying, well, they'll just deport him if they convict him again, and so it's not a problem?
Yeah, I think it's just putting him back into the position that he would have been had the procedures been properly applied in the first instance, which is that he may or may not have been convicted. If he had not been convicted, he may have been deported anyway because he didn't have any status to be here. If he did get convicted, he would have served his time and then would have had the bar of the conviction, but he would have been fairly convicted. And our point is simply that for better or for worse, he should not have that additional stigma of the conviction. And that's what the presumption of collateral consequences is all about.
Can you get to the merits? Because I think it's a very difficult case on the merits. And so could you
Certainly.
Please get to the merits?
Yes. On the merits, the courts have traditionally looked at a number of factors to determine whether there is reasonable cause to believe that the defendant is incompetent, which is the statutory standard under 18 U.S.C. section 4241. And of course, the statute also makes provision for the psychiatric or psychological examination, which, as we pointed out, Congress believed would be conducted in virtually every case before the competency hearing was held. The first factor that the courts look at is previous irrational behavior. And in this case, less than a year before the instant case, Mr. Flores Martinez had been charged in another Section 1326 case in Laredo, and his defense counsel had expressed the desire to have Mr. Flores Martinez evaluated for competency. Particularly in a motion for continuance, the attorney averred that Mr. Flores Martinez was not mentally stable and did not understand the charges against him. The government significantly in that case did not oppose a competency evaluation, but that case went away because 3 days after that motion was filed, the government moved to dismiss the case in the interest of justice. The second factor is
The district court knew of that. That was brought to the district court's attention.
The district court was told about the Laredo case. The second factor is demeanor during the proceedings in the instant case, and I won't belabor that because we did go into it in quite a bit of detail in the briefs. But in addition to the in-court erratic and disturbed behavior, there was evidence of out-of-court disturbed behavior, too. The attorneys reported that when they met with Mr. Flores Martinez, he would yell, he was angry, he was overwrought. At one point, he was crying hysterically and couldn't stop. So we believe that factor cuts in favor of the reasonable cause to believe as well.
Do you want to address your failure to let him testify? Because you're running out of time, and I want to make sure you have a chance to open on that.
Sure. The failure to allow Mr. Flores Martinez to testify, very basically, is that after the district court refused to revisit its in limine ruling on a number of subjects, defense counsel rested the defense case. Mr. Flores Martinez was not in agreement with that decision because he immediately started saying, I want to address the jury. The district court removed him from the courtroom. And we take the position that because the right to testify is one of those rare rights that can only be exercised personally by the defendant, can only be waived personally by the defendant, that the attorney had no authority to override Mr. Flores Martinez's decision on that point, and that the district court, by forcibly removing Mr. Flores Martinez from the courtroom without allowing him to testify and without exploring further the discrepancy between what the defense attorney had said and what Mr. Flores Martinez was saying, abridged Mr. Flores Martinez's constitutional right to testify. And we would point the court to Ortega versus O'Leary and also Quarles versus Commonwealth from the Kentucky Supreme Court that were similar on the facts.
Counsel, do you know where Mr. Flores Martinez is now?
I would imagine he's in Honduras, but I can't
say
for sure.
Oh, he's still in Honduras? He hasn't come back yet?
Not to my knowledge, Judge Reveley.
You wouldn't know.
I don't know.
Well, it'd be unusual for him to stay away that long.
Perhaps it would, but he's missing an arm, so perhaps it's harder for him to get back.
Mr. Crooks, can you tell me what the lawyer should have done in those circumstances where he did not believe it was in the client's best interest to testify and the client insisted at the time? What should the lawyer have done and what should the court have done at that point?
I think, may I answer?
You may.
I think what the attorney should have done is to give way, because the law is very clear that the decision to testify is the client's alone, regardless of whether it's against the attorney's advice or even whether it's in his best interest. What I think the court should have done when the court was confronted with the disagreement between the defense attorney who rested the case and Mr. Flores Martinez, who wants to testify, is to call a halt to the proceedings and to admonish Mr. Flores Martinez that he would be allowed to testify, but not on the subjects that were ruled irrelevant.
He hadn't paid any attention to instructions before. What was this judge expecting to happen except to hear more about his father's experience?
Well, and I think that's
been going on and on and on.
And at that point, the judge could have stopped him. And that's what happened in a bunch of these cases, is the defendant was allowed some leeway and was allowed to testify, and then the judge stopped the person. The judge could also give curative instructions after the defendant testified. But there were means that were short of the absolute bar on testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jim Turner representing the government in this case. To follow on Judge Reveley's question regarding where is Mr. Antonio Flores Martinez today, they gave you the timeline. When I took over this case for my colleague, the first thing I did was I checked BOP because I recognized that the 16-month term of imprisonment was nearing its end with good conduct time. It was, in fact, over on November 30th of this past year, 2011. I wasn't sure whether or not he'd been removed, so I checked with our immigration and customs folks, and they said, in fact, on December 23rd, 2011, he was removed to Honduras. Now, your question is, where is he today? We really don't know, but if he stays consistent with his timetable, he usually makes it back between 3 and 7 months, so he may be back in at any time.
Let me ask you.
Not in this record, is it, counsel?
His time that he was moved in and out is in there, but it's not laid out in the record briefs.
What do we know about his testimony in the prior trial? What did the district judge know?
The district judge did not have, as far as I can tell from this record, the specifics of the motion with respect to his competency was not laid out. Looking at the docket entries to make this record complete of the Laredo case, it was delayed. He was arrested, I think it was in March of 2009. There were five delays initiated by his counsel as they were investigating, according to the docket entries, a derivative citizenship claim, which never materialized. They did that up until they could no longer work with the individual. Counsel was substituted 2 more months, and then he moved. What all the judge knows about this is from the motion in limine, is that there was a Laredo case. We dismissed it because he'd been in jail.
I thought he did testify at a prior.
He testified in an administrative proceeding. That was he made a claim of fear. And the judge made a finding with that respect before the trial started when she addressed this competency question.
Now, what does the judge know about that?
All she knew about it was that he attested to it, the claim of fear was found without merit, and that was the end of it. That was on his administrative removal in, I believe it was May of 2010.
That was in front of an IJ? That was in front of an immigration judge?
That's part of the immigration proceeding, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, can you please tell me, I'm perplexed by the comments that the court made on December 1st, 2010. He said, unless a psychologist or a psychiatrist has opined that he is incompetent and has a basis, a medical basis for that diagnosis, then I'm ready to proceed. At that point, the court's well aware that competency is an issue, but the only person in that room who can get a diagnosis and an evaluation is the court. So he's saying, unless we have a diagnosis, but the only one who can order that is himself, and then he says he's ready to proceed. How is that? And the statute says the court shall order an evaluation. How is that the proper action to say, well, he needs this diagnosis, but since he doesn't have it, I'm going to proceed, but I'm the person who shall order it? That makes no sense. Can you explain that to me?
I don't think that the interpretation I would give that is this took place over a two-day period. And I agree with counsel that the issue in this case is whether there's a reasonable cause to believe the accused may be lacking in sufficient competency to be put to trial. Now, early on in the proceedings, he gave them time to have him evaluated by Dr. Marone.
But that was not a successful evaluation because he was uncooperative.
He deliberately walked out of it.
Right, so then that means he needs to be held by the, in the competency process where he's held over and evaluated for the 60 days. At that point, he should have been held over for the proper evaluation, not by the defense lawyer evaluation.
Well, the judge didn't make that decision sua sponte, and there was no request from the defense counsel. In fact, there was no request from the defense counsel. They were consistently attesting to the fact we believe he's competent, but he's difficult, as evidenced by his time with the doctor.
But by December 1st, there was a view that he was not competent. And at that point, shouldn't the court have continued the case and ordered this?
I don't believe she shared that view that he wasn't competent with the factual basis. And what she did was on November 30th.
Well, there's competency was an issue. It was placed at issue, and the court said that unless there's an evaluation, we're going to proceed.
Well, I think what she did, though, on the 30th was she engaged him, and I'll try to get to answer your question. She engaged him first in the colloquy, the same type of colloquy that a judge would engage a defendant in on the Rule 11 to see whether she herself, because the judge is not bound by the expert's testimony in any event. And during the course of that colloquy, he answered all the questions cogently. He answered his age, his date of birth, his name. When he began to misbehave, she admonished him, and he brought his conduct under order.
And then she also found it would be futile to send him for another evaluation after the whole deal with Dr. Marone.
But right? It's a totally different evaluation, isn't it?
Not really.
One is you're meeting with the lawyer's hired person, and the other person is you're being held specifically for a competency evaluation.
One of our cases we cite, they sent him away for an evaluation, and they came back and determined he was a malingerer. So the evaluation may end up precisely the same. It's been my experience that they will basically not cooperate there or cooperate partway there. So
there was no determination in this matter that he was malingering, though. The court, the person evaluating him when he stormed out said they couldn't make a determination, correct?
He had a mixed reaction to it. He says it could be delusional and it could be based upon logic and
could
fact.
Be delusional, could be,
but again,
faking it. We don't know. That's nothing.
But the judge isn't bound by that determination. The judge has her discretion. She can exercise her discretion. And at this point, she went in and engaged this man in a personal colloquy.
Well, she also said that she saw a difference between being unable and unwilling, and she felt that this fell in the unwilling camp.
She came down precisely on that, and that's precisely what she came down with respect to Dr. Marone's reaction to his 15-minute interview, where he was unwilling to cooperate with anyone at that point in time.
Or delusional and unable to cooperate.
And again, this would be the court's assessment. And his was a mixed assessment, asking for not having enough time.
Right. The doctor's assessment either cuts neutrally or doesn't cut in favor of him. I mean, it's either neutral some evidence that he's delusional.
And there the judge rejected, well, it's a fact, it's a fact base. He's suggesting he may be delusional, and the judge rejected that fact because she personally engaged him after that to find out what his situation was.
Well, let me ask you, was he very, I mean, I just want to know what I talked to Mr. Crooks about. Was he consistent that his point was, look, number one, you dismissed these already. You've already let me go, which is true, actually, although for perhaps a little different reason, but he's correct on that. Number two, You guys took my dad's, you know, time in the Army and whatever service he was in. You let him fight honorably for your country. You owe this to me. He was consistent in that. And I don't personally think that's delusional. It's legally incorrect and all of that. But was there ever a time that he said something sort of different or inconsistent that would show he didn't know where he was, who he was, what he was doing? Or was he just passionate about these two viewpoints, one that he'd already won, in a sense, by the dismissal of the charges, which is, frankly, legally sort of true, that he won that case, and secondly, this thing about the dad, which, again, while legally wrong, strikes me as a valid way to feel.
And that's precisely what he did. There was no evidence that I can read from this record, no evidence at all that, well, for example, he was throwing fecal material on people or acting out in any respect whatsoever. His whole point is that his father, and the record does have this, and it's in our motion in limine at page 106, was in the Merchant Marine for 8 months. And like I say, in the Laredo case, there was some investigation. The federal public defender did some investigation to determine whether or not there was a derivative citizenship claim under this theory. Unfortunately, the 8 months isn't sufficient time under the statute to qualify for the exemption for naturalization, nor is there any evidence in the record that the father set up, and he never goes further than that.
But his father did serve.
Served in a Merchant Marine.
Was honorably discharged and all of that. Okay.
Exactly. And that was what he was fixed upon. And that was all he was fixed upon. Our position would be that he did the same thing in Laredo. He was fixed upon this derivative citizenship claim. When that didn't pan out, he became obstinate with his attorneys.
Okay, so when does passion become an obsession? I mean, Mr. Crook said, well, maybe he was fixated on this and it became an obsession, and I guess he means in the legal sense of the term. So is that possible, that he has what we might call a not delusional feeling about his dad that's legally wrong, and it becomes so obsessive to him that he just can't do anything else?
It's more like a person that will not accept the truth of the situation. It's not delusional as much as the fact that these are the facts. I'm not going to accept those facts because the facts are my father was a Merchant Marine, served during World War II, and I'm entitled to be here by virtue of that service. And when he's told that's not true, that's when he gets angry. So I don't think that's delusional at all. That's based upon the circumstances he finds himself in.
All right, what about this failure to testify thing? I mean, it seems to me, on the one hand, that as a judge, if you've said, I'm not going to let you talk about X, and this person keeps wanting to talk about X, at some point, as the judge, you've got to take charge and say, look, you're not talking about X. There's no indication he wanted to talk about anything other than the dad and the citizenship thing. However, to just not go through the colloquy you typically have about whether you're going to testify, that seems a little funny with a seasoned judge here to do that, because I mean that's very standard to, you know, in any case, to make sure the defendant understands their right to testify.
Well, in this instance, I don't think there was any doubt of it. He understood his right to testify. I think what had happened, the motion in limine was filed the day before or several days before trial, and during the course of the discussion we asked that three things be kept out, in particular the dismissal of the Laredo indictment, the citizenship and the domicile of his father, and the fear of returning to Honduras. And the question there was on relevancy. Our objection was on relevancy basis entirely all the way through. I think what happened at trial, consistent with Rule 103 of the Rules of Evidence, counsel proffered his testimony that he would offer. The judge says, I'm not changing the rule. It's not relevant. It stays out.
Right, but then at that point, when he says, I want to testify, you agree that he had a constitutional right to testify, right? Okay.
Yes.
And you agree that he was not allowed to testify about anything, not just objectionable matters, but about anything, correct?
Well, you know, the difficulty I have with that is the proffer came from his attorney.
Right, but we're not talking about what his attorney wanted him to testify about or said he would testify. He was not factually allowed to testify about anything, was he? Correct?
No, I don't think that's correct at all, because the judge was relying upon counsel's proffer of what he was going to testify to.
Right, but he was not allowed to testify about anything, was he?
And he's not allowed, even if his right to testify, he's still not, that doesn't give him the right to testify about immaterial and irrelevant matters.
Right, but you don't know, and the judge doesn't know, that he would only say immaterial things when he actually got on the stand. He was prevented from getting on the stand, and we'll never know what he would have testified to because he was denied the opportunity to testify. Do you know of any case that would support an actual prohibition of the person being allowed to get on the stand? The judge has to go through the motions. The person has to start talking about the irrelevant things, and then the judge says, don't talk about those irrelevant things or I'm going to make you sit down. You're not allowed to talk about those. And then they take the jury out and they lecture them, and they do that a couple of times. And then once it's clear that he has nothing else to say but the irrelevant things, then the judge can say, counsel, you're done. But the judge didn't go through that process. So for all practical purpose, he was not allowed to testify about anything. Do you know of any case throughout the country where they allowed a complete prohibition on a defendant's right to testify, as was happening in this case?
I also don't think there's any case across the country, Your Honor, in which prior to trial, in a most limiting circumstance, what the proper testimony was going to be was discussed, and that the attorney.
But it's your position, though, that there is no case that you can cite to me that would have allowed this. Is that correct?
Well, my position is that there was no violation of his right to testify by virtue of the
judge's
reliance upon counsel.
Can you answer my question, counsel?
Yes. No, Your Honor.
Do you know of any case in America where the judge completely kept the defendant off the stand, as was happened in this case?
No, Your Honor. There is no case of that nature. There's none like this.
Can I just be clear? He was given an opportunity to make a bill and refused, right? The defendant himself.
He was. I think afterwards there was a bill, and counsel made the bill for him.
No, understand it, he was allowed the bill, and then am I misstating the record? We'll ask Mr. Crooks.
I think what happened was, the record's clear, he began to rant, as is wont to do with his attorney.
Right, but my understanding was, after he was removed, then he came back, then the lawyer asked, can I make a bill? Then the defendant refused to say anything, then the lawyer made the proffer.
I think the attorney made the proffer, Your Honor. It's my recollection of the record. I'll be honest with you. I think he was removed from the courtroom when he began to rant.
Is this de novo review?
I think the Seventh Circuit states it well. It infringes upon a constitutional right. It's de novo review, considering the judge's evidentiary discretion in admitting the testimony or proffer testimony in this instance.
Do you agree that the method that I articulated about how you let the person testify and you admonish them and then that you shut them down is the normal procedure that people use in these sorts of circumstances?
I honestly don't, because I haven't seen it done quite that way. It usually comes up in our context in 2055. Ordinarily, they will take the stand and testify, and ordinarily, I find it's relevant to their defense, although it's not entirely cogent or persuasive.
My notes have that at record 424, he refused to speak after the lawyer was granted a bill of exception. So I asked Mr. Crooks to address that, because I do think he refused to speak. And I think that is a little different than just the lawyer proffer. But I don't have the whole record here, but I just have my notes on that.
I believe we've addressed every concern we have. You have additional questions, I'll...
If we find that that was violated, his right to testify, what is the remedy, counsel?
Well, the remedy there is simply vacation of the conviction for retrial. It's remedy for retrial, and the case will be pending when and if he comes back into the United States.
And that's not unusual.
It's pretty much the normal. One, I can assure the court, that's pretty
what
much
now?
The, I can assure the court that is the normal. That's pretty
yeah,
much
yeah, that's the normal. Case. So there are lots of cases that are pending if people ever come back to this country.
Yeah, this is.
Before I forget, I just wanted to address Judge Haynes' point. What happened was that after the case completely closed, outside the presence of the jury, the defense attorney asked if he could make a bill with the client testifying, and he did refuse. So then the attorney just testified to what
he but thought. I think that's kind of significant, because it's before the charge is read. So had Mr. Flores Martinez said, I am a man of great substance, and just started rambling about things besides the dad, which he would have had a right to talk about, his background and kind of who he is, the judge could have reconsidered. That's the whole point of a bill, could have reconsidered and then allowed him to testify, because the charge hadn't been read, the jury hadn't been sent back to deliberate. So that's the whole point of a bill, and at that point, he refused to speak, which is why the lawyer then made the proffer, and I think that's a fairly significant point.
Well, I mean, perhaps it would have been better if at that point he would have reconsidered, but I think this whole case is colored by mental illness, honestly, and by bad relations between the defense attorney and the client. And where I would come down on that issue is that by asserting his right to testify, he shifted the burden of proving it was harmless over to the government. So in other words, this is not a situation where he has to show affirmatively that his right was violated in some meaningful way. It's for the government to show the opposite. And perhaps that would have been better, but on these facts,
I mean, we're still waiting to hear what he would have talked about that hadn't been limited out. I'm still wondering, we're sitting here in oral argument in the Fifth Circuit, and I have no idea what this man is saying he would have talked about that had not been limited out.
Well, you know, I think the content of his testimony might not have been so important as simply allowing the jury to see him and to hear him talk in his own words. And I think just that whole assessment of his demeanor could have raised some real doubts in the jury's mind about his mental state.
Mr. Crooks, do you bear the burden of telling us what he would have talked about had he been allowed to testify?
No, Your Honor. No case has imposed that requirement that I have been able to find.
Is there any case that has upheld a conviction where the defendant was completely not allowed to testify, as in this case?
None that I have been able to find, Your Honor.
Have you done research on this?
Copious research, and I've found none. I did want to cover just the two other points that the court looks at with regard to the reasonable cause to believe that the defendant's incompetent. And one of them is prior medical opinion on competency. In this case, we didn't have any prior medical opinion finding Mr. Flores-Martinez incompetent, but the flip side of that is there was no medical opinion finding him competent because the only medical professional to take a look at him was not able to come to a conclusion. And I just point out, in Drope versus Missouri, the Supreme Court found it was extremely significant that there was no medical opinion finding the defendant competent. And last, opinion of defense counsel, which the Supreme Court said in Medina versus California, is an important factor. Here we have not just present defense counsel, but we have completely different defense counsel in the prior Laredo case questioning the defendant's competency.
Opposing counsel, Mr. Turner, relies extensively on the fact that the judge looked him eyeball to eyeball, asked him some questions, and made her own determination. Is that enough to satisfy that she did not abuse her discretion?
No, it is not, Your Honor. The court looks at all these factors, and the reasonable cause to believe standard is quite low. And honestly, with all due respect to Judge Tagle, I don't think she had had that much interaction with the defendant. If you look, his first court appearance that we have a record of was before the magistrate judge, and the magistrate judge actually questioned whether he should have his competency evaluated. And so that's another jurist who's eyeballed this person and who has thought
something's wrong. Was Judge Taglia aware of that? Did someone say, did you know the magistrate judge just last month asked the same competency questions?
She was not made aware of that, but she was made aware of the problems in the Laredo case. And certainly the disruptive behavior is out of the ordinary. Defendants can be cantankerous, but this is a whole different level of cantankerousness. And I did want to just clarify very briefly the events of November 30th versus December 1st. What happened on November 30th was that defense counsel had only just, from the facts header on the letter, gotten the letter from Dr. Moron, and I don't think he had fully digested it. And at that point, he was kind of unclear about his position. What happened was overnight, defense counsel thought about it some more, agonized over it. He went the next morning with his supervisor and talked to Mr. Flores Martinez, and at that point was when it really crystallized, he's not competent, he can't assist in his defense. And that was when the motion was made and rejected. Thank you.
Thank you. This case is submitted.